Well, this morning is the second Sunday of Easter, and as is our tradition, on the second Sunday of Easter, we celebrate baptism. So to get us started this morning, why don't you turn to neighbor, and when you think of water, the metaphor water in the scriptures, or baptism, what does that symbolize to you? Okay, I'll give you a couple minutes, turn to neighbor, and discuss. All right. So what are we thinking? Any thoughts? Topo. Chico. Yeah. Why is it so good? I'm not sure. Anybody else?
Minerals.
Minerals? Okay. Cleansing. Good. So I think cleansing is in one of the main metaphors that we think of, right? I was thinking through this, and a story came to mind. So several years ago, some of us went to Afghanistan to visit one of the partnerships we had there. And Johnny Seafelt, I have a picture of Johnny up here. I think he's in the back, was with me. And so we had come off of 3 or 4 days of just an exhausting travel schedule to get there. I think we went from it was Belgium to Dubai to Kabul. And then finally we land in Mazar Sharif, which is like 3 or 4 days of travel. You're delirious at the point. The sun had already set. We arrived, you know, at night. And we get picked up by the host. And our first stop was to stop at the bodega just to pick up supplies. And so as we're driving in, there's no streetlights and it was really, really dark. I have a picture here. So this is a part where there was a streetlight, but where we were driving, most of the city doesn't have lights. And you see the yellow stripes? Okay. So during the day, those yellow stripes are very important. They tell you that there's gullies on the side of the road, and it's where everyone's sewage from their homes flow out of. Okay. So as we're pulling over to this bodega, our van pulls up right next to it, and our host fails to give us this information. You see where this is going. So as we step out of the car, the first person to get out was poor Johnny, and he steps out. His first step into Afghanistan was probably mid-calf deep in raw sewage. So he steps in. We're like, ah! So any of us would have had a full-blown panic attack. But Johnny's cool as a cucumber, just doesn't even flinch, and he goes, oh, I'll just wash it off later. And so we go into the bodega. We get our supplies. As we get to the place we're staying, we don't let him in. We make him take off his pants and his shoes before he comes in the house, before he bathes. And so you imagine that cleansing was very important, right? And so I think most of us, when we think of baptism, we think of it as a cleansing ritual. And I think that meaning is true and is important. But what Jesus does is pretty significant. Because when he offers himself to be baptized, everyone freaks out. They're like, what? How is this whole and healthy person? Why does he need a cleansing ritual? And in that moment, he's expanding our understanding of what baptism is. It is cleansing, yes, but perhaps it's more than that. This is what Pittman McGehee says. He says, there's an energy process, something going on in the baptismal ritual that is more than human, even while it's fairly transparent. Our story tells us that God took clay and moved the mist over it, blowing the spirit into it, animating and ensouling it to become a human being. We enact that same process of baptism, of the baptism sacrament. We take a human being, whether a baby or an adult, or many of us adults, we're still acting out of our inner child. So it's probably the same thing. And we take the dust that we are, we put water onto it, or we put them in the water, and we invoke the spirit, and boom, they are animated into a new consciousness, a new life, a new sense of being, whether they're aware of it or not. And I love this last statement. Baptism is not the kind of initiation that you outgrow. Baptism is a kind of initiation into which you grow. Isn't that beautiful? And so this morning, I'd like to maybe offer a couple more symbols, and then we're going to invite our baptizees and hear their story. Cool. So as is our custom, why don't you go ahead and read Romans chapter 6, verse 1 through 4. We'll have it on the screens and read it aloud with the neighbor. All right. All right. Romans 6, verse 1. Paul writes, "What then are we to say? Should we continue in sin? Should we continue to live to earn love when love's already offered to us, that grace may abound?" He said, "By no means. How can we who died to sin, the ways we're still trying to earn love in this world, go on living in it? Do you not know that all of us have been baptized into Christ Jesus? We're baptized into his death, so we're participating in that. Therefore, as we have been buried with him by baptism into death, so that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father," I love this last statement, "so we too might walk in the newness of life." And perhaps the symbol of baptism is to remind us of the water in the womb. That new life is still happening. That God isn't done creating and is still birthing things in us. You know, I think about our Genesis origin poem, which says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and void, and darkness covered over the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters." So even in the origin poem, it was like a womb. And out of darkness and water, God created. Or in Romans, Paul says this, "We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now." So this whole earth is still being birthed. There's labor pain. And not only the creation, but we ourselves. And I think sometimes we think of baptism as this ritual that represents one birth. And perhaps it's supposed to remind us that things are continuing to birth. God is still birthing things in us. So last week, Jason shared a wonderful story of his experience of Jordan being born. I had that experience, but I have two boys, and both experiences of being in the delivery room were very different. So what I didn't know is hospitals have different philosophies, I guess. And so Joshua, my older one, was born at Seton Central, which is kind of like the OG hospital of Austin. And so they're a little more old school, and so they hid all the messiness. The lights were dim. There's lots of coverings everywhere. I think before they put him on Karen's chest, they did like a quick wipe down. So for me, it was just romantic and beautiful. I was like, oh, birthing is so wonderful, right? And I remember seeing Joshua for the first time, and I didn't know I had this capacity to love. It's still maybe the most beautiful experience, you know, I've experienced in my life. So when Noah was ready to be born, I was like, oh, it's so beautiful. Joshua should be in the room as well. So we went to St. David's, I guess a newer school hospital, where instead of dimming the lights, they turned up the lights. Instead of hiding everything, they showed everything. At one point, I was like, this is very different than my first one, right? And then Noah comes out, and I look at Joshua's face, and he's like, so my apologies, son. So the birthing process, I propose, is equally beautiful. It's so stunningly magical when you see new life. It's equally beautiful and equally messy. And I think as we walk through life and we're experiencing both the beauty and the messiness of God still birthing in us, I think our baptism is supposed to remind us of that. If you were here for our Good Friday installation at the Mary station where Jesus meets his mother, we had a quote from Meister Eckhart, and this is what it said. "And what good is it to me if Mary is full of grace, if I am not also full of grace? What good is it to me for the Creator to give birth to his Son, if I do not also give birth to him in my time and culture?" He says, "This then is the fullness of time when the Son of Man is begotten in us." And so maybe a question we can ask is, How does baptism remind us of what God is continuing to birth in us? That God is still birthing in all of us. All right, and then let's finish this up in verse 8. It says, if we have died with Christ, we believe that we will also live with him. We know that Christ, being raised from the dead, will never die again. That death isn't the end of our story. Death no longer has dominion over him. The death he died to sin once and for all, but the life he lives to God. And then he says this. He says, so you also, like there's this sense of empowerment, isn't there? You also must consider yourselves dead to sin and alive to God in Christ Jesus. And there's this sense in our baptism that as God's birthing, he's empowering us to live in this world. Pittman McGahee, who sometimes teaches at the Episcopal Seminary, in his book, The Invisible Church, he says this. To truly understand baptism is to get a sense of the depth and breadth of this significant thing that has been trivialized into your ticket to heaven. Baptism is not a ticket into heaven, but a ticket into a way to be in this world that is meaningful and healthy. And then he says this, that's what the good father and mother do for the child. They nurture the child and empower her to live in a world that is meaningful, healthy, and abundant, rather than a way that is shameful and limited by fear and infantilism. So in our baptism, God's empowering us. As a great parent, so you can live in this world. You can represent me in this world. And as a parent, it's sometimes a little tricky to decipher what's about me and what's actually empowering in the child. So I've told you that my son Josh was a senior in high school, and I've been surprisingly emotional about it. And so every event, it's like, oh, it's his last Christmas at home. Oh, it's his last spring break. And that grief is meaningful and it's healthy, but it's about me. And it's okay for me to grieve that. But there's also a side of it where I'm genuinely excited. He's going to do great in this world. He's got the tools. He doesn't really need us that much anymore. And that's a fantastic thing. And I'm empowering him to live in this world. And so for us, maybe we can ask this question. You know, as baptism reminds us that God is empowering us to live and love in this world, how is God as a loving parent empowering you today? What does that look like? All right. And so with those symbols in mind, I want to invite a couple of our baptizees to come up. And so we're going to have Meredith and David. So if you guys want to come up, let's welcome them up. There's a second mic here somewhere. All right. So maybe you just want to tell us a little bit about yourselves and kind of how your story starts. And I think, David, your story starts in Utah.
It does. Yeah. I'm from Utah, and I was raised in the Mormon church. After high school, I spent 2 years in West Africa, where I served as a missionary for the church. And then I
How moved. Was that experience there?
Oh, I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Actually, I enjoyed it every day.
Yeah.
And I was kind of sad to see it go after I returned home. Kind of had some reverse culture shock as well. Lots of options down the cereal aisle.
Yeah. Sure. It's like the cereal aisle. You're like,
yeah,
why so
amazing.
Many?
Holy cow.
Okay. So from West Africa, where did you go from there?
Well, I kind of missed being in kind of another culture, so I decided to go to BYU Hawaii,
okay. Which
is the Hawaii version of Brigham Young University. And I was there for a couple of years studying English. And then I had kind of like a crisis of faith. I started doubting and didn't really think I believed in Mormonism anymore. And then I decided to leave BYU Hawaii. And then I eventually left religion entirely. Became an atheist. And then that's when I moved to Texas to live with my older sister. And then eventually we moved to Austin, where I went to UT and finished my degree. This time I added philosophy just to help me get a job after I graduated.
Yeah, some practical skills.
Yes,
I should definitely add philosophy to that.
I'm really good at analysis. Yeah, yeah. And then I started working at a place called People's Community Clinic here in Austin. It's a nonprofit clinic. And I work as a program manager for a program for kids with like learning problems. And okay. I've been there ever since.
Okay. And then, so in that season, was it after college that you started to do improv?
Yeah.
And then that's after. Where you met Meredith, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So does either of you want to share your first improv story together?
Oh, okay. Well, we got to know each other through improv because he was giving me rides back to campus. I was a student at UT at the time. And I think our first, or the only sketch I remember us doing together involved you being injured, badly injured, and I had to call the paramedics. There was a lot of panic and chaos.
So in that panic and chaos, the chemistry formed.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
There's a connection.
Fermented.
Yeah, fermented. Yeah. I like that. So then for you, Meredith, your story kind of is a little more Texas-centric, right?
Yeah.
But it kind of, there's a little journey in there as well, right?
Yeah. I was born and raised in Alabama and grew up going to church. And then we moved to Texas when I was 18. When I was 14, I also had a crisis of faith. And I started just questioning everything that I was raised to believe.
Mm-hmm. Which as a 14-year-old is really healthy, right? Developmentally, that's when you start asking questions.
Yeah, it fit the developmental timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was also feeling like I didn't fit in there. And so that was also like spurring those questions, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I was kind of struggling with that on and off through high school, and then we moved to Houston right after, and I went to UT, lived in Austin, and then moved back to Houston when I graduated with a degree in geography, and I was like, okay, I have to figure out. I had a similar experience. What kind of job am I going to get? And so I moved back home. Okay. Got a job in Houston, and
then it was your mother who helped you find Vox. Could you tell us about
that? Yeah, so while I was at UT,
so you had kind of walked away from the church for a while.
I had, yeah. I would go when I was home, but I was just going to, you know, not cause any family
to appease
rifts.
Mom.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I was feeling a little bit like socially disconnected when mm-hmm. I was at UT. I was a senior. And my mom was like, I found this church, in Austin called Vox Venia, and, you should check. I think you'd like it. Like, I think you would fit well there and you would enjoy it. And I was like, okay. And I checked it out and I thought I would like it, but I didn't have a car at the time. And I was still kind of skeptical, nervous about
sure.
going back to church, especially by myself.
Yeah. And this is kind of a strange one. Right. So granted, yeah.
It was kind of what I was like, this is the coolest church I've heard of. Like, this is kind of what I thought a Christian community would look like in my head.
Yeah.
But I was still skeptical.
Yeah.
And so I ended up not going. Mm-hmm. And then David and I started going in December.
Okay, so you two started hanging out. So your journeys kind of intersect, and then it kind of leads us here, right? So David, could you tell us a little bit? So how do you go from, so you're at UT, you had started a club, co-founded, and then can you tell us about that, and then how does that journey lead you to faith?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I had started a version of the Secular Student Alliance at UT, and I was super into this for a long time.
And it's still ongoing, this club that you started.
I think it is. Yeah. I'm one of the founding fathers. I can put that on my resume. anyway, so I was really involved in that, and then I graduated. And then I went through kind of a really bad breakup at the time. And I fell into this very like deep depression. And eventually I got a hold of Schopenhauer and some of the pessimist philosophers.
Who's giving language to what you were feeling.
They were actually like, I felt like it was like, these guys are speaking the truth, you know? And I just became super obsessed with that. Like, and I became to a point where like, I questioned everything, myself, just everything I believed, everything about the world. I even became kind of like a, like almost like a nihilist at one point. But then, at one point I started, reapproaching kind of religion, because I was kind of drawn to the mystics. I started kind of looking at Buddhism and eventually like started reading, Taoist texts, and I kind of identified with, a lot of what they were saying to a certain degree. And then I eventually came around to some Christian mystics like Meister Eckhart, for example. He was my favorite. And I felt like I could really identify with a lot of that, even though I feel like I felt like I didn't really believe in a God yet, at that point. And then I had kind of like an enlightenment experience. There was a moment where, I don't know, I just felt like suddenly at one with kind of the universe or life or whatever it was. And for like a month and a, about a month and a half after that, I was able to see the good and the beautiful in everyone. I don't know. It seemed just so obvious to me. And I felt like I had like accepted myself, forgiven myself. And I felt like this experience also confirmed to me that there was something real about spirituality, like something real, like religion is pointing to something real. Like I became convinced of that, even though at this time I still wasn't a Christian and I still wasn't even sure if I believed in a God.
Mm-hmm. And so it felt like someone or something was drawing you towards faith, right?
Definitely. Yeah.
And then how about for you, Meredith, then? And so you kind of leave the church for a little bit, and kind of what is that journey back? What does that look like?
Yeah, so I started going to a church in Houston called Ecclesia, and my mom found out about it through Vox. And I decided to go, and I was still skeptical, but I felt like I was finally seeing Jesus clearly for the first time, unfiltered through like a cultural bias. And I was just really inspired by the openness, the welcoming, the inclusiveness of Jesus' love that was being talked about there. But I didn't quite believe in who Jesus said he was. Yeah, I wasn't ready to do that. And I didn't know if I believed that God was present and active in our lives. I didn't really have a spirituality at that point, I think.
And then, so the two of you then are starting to hang out at that point, right?
Yeah.
And then you decide to read the Gospels together.
Yeah.
Whose idea was that? Do you remember?
It was kind of a mutual idea. He went to Ecclesia with me, and that kind of sparked something in him. And so I think you may have started reading them first.
Yeah.
And then, we started reading them together, and we started praying together.
So as you're reading them, was there something in particular that jumped out at you?
Well, the Sermon on the Mount, definitely. I don't know if you have.
Oh, well, I think you wanted to hear about my bus stop story, too.
Okay,
right?
Sure.
Okay. I'll go into that.
Mm-hmm. So this is before you started reading the Gospels?
I mean, we had read them a little bit. Okay. We had actually read some.
So it's while you're reading it.
The whole experience. It's kind of hard to get details down sometimes. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there was one day where I was at a bus stop. I think this was January. And, I mean, there was a sunbeam, like a beam of light. And suddenly I felt like I could see God in it. And I felt like I could see, like I could feel God's love in the heat. And then I could see his wisdom in the light. And I felt like I could, like I looked up at the sun or towards the sun. And I felt like I could almost see like heralding angels coming out of there. And then that afternoon, I was that same ability I had before to see the good and the beautiful in everyone it returned with full force. I almost cried because it was just so overwhelming. But I felt like at that point also that I was being called to Christ specifically, that he was calling me. And then I also was feeling called to serve him in some way, as like some kind of minister or pastor, chaplain or something. And of course, at this point, I still wasn't quite sure how I felt about him, even though I kind of like felt maybe he was calling me.
Yeah, sure.
And then that's when I reapproached, especially the Sermon on the Mount. And I fasted and prayed that next weekend just to kind of get a confirmation. And I tell you, when I read that Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5-8, I didn't see just like good moral principles or ideals or teachings. I saw divinity itself in that. I saw God's true character. Like Jesus was the face of God. And I felt like if we were a prayer in heart, we can see that. And I just felt myself truly believing in him and having faith finally.
Mm-hmm. So it was kind of that mystical experience you had.
Yeah.
That's very personal. But then as you're reading the scriptures, then it kind of came to life.
It came to life.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. First time ever. I had never felt that way as a Mormon about the sermon, especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for, and either of you can answer this, as you are growing into your baptism, what are some of the ways you've experienced grace?
So we actually had a similar kind of feeling of being called, like around the same time. And I had started believing, and, you know, my spirituality was returning, and I felt like my eyes had been opened for the first time. Like I was seeing clearly for the first time. When I would read the Bible, I wanted to commit to, you know, what Jesus is teaching. And so at this point, we were both starting to grow in our spirituality. And we had this one day where we kind of both had this spark, I like to call it, where we had this pop into our head of, you know, he told me about the feeling called to ministry. And then I was telling him that I had been thinking about counseling and I was feeling drawn to that. And then this school, the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology, kind of popped into my head, and I sent him the link, and it was just this like crazy energy that was going on. We were sharing, and all of a sudden this path had kind of been shown to us. But I was, after that, I was still had a lot of fears and worries. What might people say? What might they think? The potential insecurity involved in taking a risk like that. So I was feeling kind of paralyzed with indecision. And I couldn't decide. I couldn't just say yes to this. And we decided to go camping about a month ago. And we were doing lots of praying and pondering. And I feel like I was given through grace that weekend the faith and the trust in God to commit to that, to say yes to that new path that God was calling us to.
And so this baptism really is a shift in direction of your life, even coinciding with the experience and gospels, and then even what's next for you in both of your vocations, right?
It is, yes.
And so, David, what can you, what do you imagine it will look like? So you're going to go and do your MDiv there.
Yeah.
And then Meredith, you're going to do a counseling degree. And then this is the school that Sam Lee went to, and you've talked to Sam as well.
We have. Right? Yeah. He gave some great advice.
To go or not go?
To go.
I'm just kidding. Yeah.
Unless he wants to talk to us afterwards.
And then, so what do you envision, you know, if you were to imagine where this path of baptism takes you, let's say in 5 years, what do you imagine that looks like?
Well, that's a good question. I'm feeling called to that program specifically and to doing some kind of work in ministry, but I'm not sure exactly how that will look. But we do imagine ourselves working together a lot. And we both feel like I've told Meredith before that, and I really believe this, but that she is the most Christ-like person I know. And I feel like Christ is by far the best counselor. And so her going into counseling, she'll be able to bring the Spirit there. And there will be some real healing there. So I can see us working together a lot, learning from the people up there at the school, getting involved in local congregations, whatever that looks like. But we do plan on being total equals, partners, starting a family together possibly at some point. Do you want to add anything, Meredith?
Yeah, I think just continuing that spirit of collaboration that has kind of always been how our relationship is, and just serving God together, I think, is how we definitely envision the future.
Oh, well, thank you for letting us be a part of it, and so thanks for sharing your story. Let's give him a hand. And then next up, we have Errol. Let's welcome Errol. Let's welcome Errol, as Errol has welcomed many of us before.
Oh, thank you.
Grab this seat. He's one of our hosts, so you've probably been greeted by a big smile.
Yeah, I'm good at that.
You've got a good smile. So can you tell us a bit of your origin story that starts in... not Milwaukee, but in Wisconsin,
close.
Right?
Yeah, close. Whitewater, Wisconsin.
I just
Wisconsin.
Wanted to say Milwaukee.
I know. Whitewater, Wisconsin, small college town, but also kind of a farming community. And it was an interesting place to grow up because kids were either farm kids or they were the kids of professors at a university. And so you got a lot of interesting dynamics there. And growing up, for me, both my parents were teachers, and as I look back at it now, I very much grew up on the God of higher education, and or the God of intelligence or reason or whatever. From an early age, you know, it was clear that my parents, my dad was Lutheran growing up, my mom Methodist, and when they got together, they decided that they didn't want to raise their kids with any sort of faith. So they said, well, you can go ahead and, you know, if you feel the pull, go ahead and do that. And my mom reminded me of that recently when I told her about my faith now. And she said, I you know, you always could have gone. And so
and it was kind of a mixed message, though. Like, you can go, but then simultaneously they would kind of bash religion and Christianity, right?
Yeah, it was very much a better than, smarter than. It was many times I'd hear Karl Marx's opiate of the masses regarding religion. And so, you know, I picked that battle for a lot of years.
Did you feel yourself drawn to it as a child?
You know, no, I was just so prideful. And what got such affirmation and validation from grades and being liked that it was just, that was serving me so well.
Yeah.
I thought this was it.
Yeah. So you were given the God of intelligence and reason. Yes. And you were appeasing this God really well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I was very, I was very dedicated to that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And then so you head off to college and now you kind of run your own business. Can you tell us a bit about that journey?
Yeah, that's been an interesting journey. About 5 years ago, a little more of my story just to kind of jump into it. I was having some personal issues I was dealing with a job that I really didn't like anymore. And I was talking with my buddy Brian, who now lives in, he's here today, he lives in Austin. And a few years before then, he had come down here with his family, and I would visit him here. And he said, well, if you get your own business going, you don't need to do it from Wisconsin. You could do it from here, and I really love the area. So, you know, that started the thinking of, yeah, I could just pick up and move. But I had been running my whole life, you know. I lived on the East Coast. I lived in Chicago for 10 years. I lived everywhere, you know, trying to go to places where, you know, I could be happy or something.
And, are you a 7 on the Enneagram?
Yes.
Yes. So I am. Am I. We've been running our whole lives,
yes.
Errol.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. You know what I find now is that I enjoy planning travel and trips,
as
but I don't
do
like
I.
actually taking them anymore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can relate to that. Yeah, that's good. So if anyone needs travel planning,
yes.
Call Errol.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I interrupted
That's
you.
Okay. That's okay.
So you found your way to Austin.
I found my way to Austin. It wasn't though, a real reactionary thing to do for me. It was very well thought out. In September of 2011, I woke up in jail from a DUI and didn't know how I had gotten there or anything. Kind of pieced it together later. But that started the path of, you know, looking at my life and the way I was living it. And it got me, by God's grace, now I see, opened my mind to, you know, how I was living my life in a very sort of selfish, self-centered way. And I don't know why, but I paid attention at those outpatient programs on alcohol. And I realized I was never a daily drinker, but when I drank, I really drank, you know. It was in Wisconsin. It was a competition. It was a very prideful thing, how much you could drink. And I thought that was just how people lived. You know, I thought that was okay. And I realized alcoholism can be, and for my case, I don't know when I'm going to stop.
Sure. Yeah. There's no off switch.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So how do you go then from born into a family of parents of atheists?
Yes.
Right. And then the journey from DUI to AA. Mm. Then how does that get you to Vox?
So I started, I had someone who told me, well, in outpatient, you should go check out these AA meetings. And I thought, you know, okay, I'll check it out. And by the end of the first 30 minutes, I'm like everyone in here, you know, this is my place. You know, I the stories are different, the details, but I've learned that if we focus on the differences, we'll never be happy, joyous, and free. You know, we'll just be, you know. So the key is the similarities. How am I like these people in what I struggle with? So ultimately, that program, the 12-step program, is a program of higher power, they call it, or God. God is your understanding at the time, because you know, they don't base it on any particular religion or anything. They found that people recovered as long as they believed in something greater than themselves, and they weren't the center of the universe anymore. And so I could relate to that, you know. I was the center of the universe for all those years. So this was an opportunity for me to kind of just really surrender in doing the steps of this program. And through that, it just opened my eyes to, you know, more of, in my conversations with my buddy Brian, more of the scriptures and more reading and Richard Rohr and, you know, Thomas Merton. And I'm just, you know, I was reading books. I don't think I had read a book in, you know, since college when I was forced to, you know. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I'm able to read books and I'm interested in this stuff. And ultimately, I see now in my life, it's a life of more service, and I got to get out of my own head. I got to be helpful. And I try to do that as best I can. If I sit around and use my mind and the old ways of, you know, figuring things out, it's going to go bad. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you actually found Vox through a book. Isn't that true?
Yes. Yes. My friend Brian told me when I moved here, he told me about different churches. We tried different churches. And then he had found a mention of Vox in a book from Jen Hatmaker. And he said, let's go check that out. And so I came over here and I checked out. And for the first 6 months or so, I was, it was like every 2 or 3 weeks or whatever. I was kind of distant. Actually, probably more like the first year. You know, I really wasn't involved. But something changed, you know, and I grew more in my spirituality and my recovery and working with guys and recovery. And it just called me to serving more in this community too.
Yeah. And so how do you go from a higher power in AA to wanting to get baptized and to follow Christ?
Oh, you know, it's just more surrender of my pride and ego and, you know, the root of all this, and looking back at my life and seeing, you know, God and Jesus in those moments is I only see him as I look back. I didn't see him at the time at all.
Like, and God's always been present in your life.
Yes.
And now you're seeing how.
Yes. Yeah. And I was kicking and screaming the whole way to, you know, to take my own path. And ultimately, it just, the draw was further and further of surrender and Jesus and God. Mm-hmm. And so that brings me to today.
Yeah. And then what do you sense that God's empowering in you as you move forward and grow into your baptism?
Oh, lately in my life, there's been a lot of, you know, how do I say, people not really agreeing with me or not agreeing with the way I do what I do, you know, and just, I feel that growth in the areas of patience, understanding, that, you know, people are where they're at. I'm where I'm at. Acceptance. I don't need to be liked right now by any individual. I deep down, that's one of my toughest things is, oh God, I got to be liked by everybody, you know, but it's just not true, you know, and this is part of my growth in today, knowing that with him, that's ultimately all I need.
Yeah, to rest into your truest being,
yes.
Which is God's love for you, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks for letting us celebrate with you.
Thanks, Gideon.
I'm going to read that quote one last time. I think we have it up there. And this is what we're doing together with these three. We enact that same process of the baptism sacrament. We take a human being, whether a baby or an adult, and we take the dust that we are, and we put water onto them, or we put them in the water, and we invoke the Spirit. They are animated into new consciousness, a new life, a new sense of being, whether they're aware of it or not. Baptism is not the kind of initiation that you outgrow. Baptism is a kind of initiation into which you grow.